Hi there, I'm Krish Saroy and welcome to the Sacred Wild Podcast. Each week I show you how to live your purpose and discover your own sacred wild spirit. On the podcast we explore the nexus point where nature, consciousness, leadership and activism come together. I talk with thought leaders to get their insights and wisdom about our collective transformation. I also show you how to own your power, give your gifts and make your highest impact on this world. So with that, let's dive into this next episode. Okay, welcome to the Sacred Wild Podcast, everyone. I tell you, I'm absolutely delighted to have Philip Cargom on with us. Philip is the former chosen chief of the Order of Bards, Ovaries and Druids. He's a psychologist, an author, and frankly, just a really good human being in the world. So welcome, Philip. Lovely to have you today.
Hi, lovely to see you, Chris. Yeah.
So what we're going to be exploring with Philip really is, Philip is one of the preeminent thinkers on kind of nature and spirituality and holism in the UK. So that's where we're going to be going today. So Philip, can you maybe just tell us a little bit about yourself and kind of what your path has been up to this date?
Well, I grew up in Notting Hill Gate when I was young, and it's hard to believe for myself even that you know, I was born in 1952 and that's 7 years after the end of the Second World War. And of course, when you're a kid growing up in the 1950s, there was no way that I was aware of that. It was only looking back in my 40s almost, looking back, I realized, gosh, that's really near to a major historical period, you know. And then I remember how there were bomb sites. You know, London was full of bomb sites. Mm. It's again something we've kind of forgotten. But that's how national car parks became so successful, is they went around buying up bomb sites and just
right.
Cars and, yeah. So the reason I mention that is because it meant that when I did go into nature, and my parents took me out to say Richmond Park on a Sunday or something like that, the contrast was just so massive from being in Notting Hill Gate and, being in this urban environment, which was a bit degraded, you know, with these bomb sites and so on, to then suddenly being with trees and, you know, out in the water. I just absolutely adored it. And then we got in a little Fiat 500. My dad was tall, you know, he was about 6 foot. And my mom and my sister, you know, I don't know how we did. We all piled into this Fiat 500. And drove to Germany across,
wow.
And when I was young, and when we were on this trip, I apparently, they did a pee break, and I started walking into the forest, and I didn't want to come back. I didn't want to get back, I don't know if I remember it, or I've just been told it, and you know the way you can never tell with really old memories. But that sort of call of the forest, the call of the wild, you know, has always been really strong in me. And then the environmental awareness came in. There was a song called, the name's escaped me from it. It'll come back to me in a minute. Neil Young, A Look at Mother Nature on the Run in the 1970s.
Yeah.
I dreamed I saw a spaceship. You know, I think a spaceship rescuing all of us. But this line, Look at Mother Nature on the Run in the 1970s. You know, and crikey, you know, that's 50 years ago now. And
crazy, and
look at how much more on the run Mother Nature has been with the degradation of the environment. So it's always been a theme through my life, really. Getting back to the wild in some way.
And how did you come to Druidry as a path? Because it's a very specific pathway, obviously.
Yeah. Well, my dad knew the old chief Druid who ran a college in London. And I met him when I was 11, and he was like a sort of family friend. And so he would visit often, and he and my dad, they were both historians. They would have endless conversations deep into the night about history and so on. And then at the same time as meeting him, I read a book called The Life of the Buddha. Because another friend of my father's was Christmas Humphreys, who had started the Buddhist Society in London, and I remember reading The Life of the Buddha, you know, and of him, the story of him gaining enlightenment under a under a tree. You
know? Under the Bodhi tree.
Yeah, under the Bodhi tree, exactly. And I remember thinking at that was when I feel I woke up, really. It was like, I can't really remember much prior to 11, but then it was like, this is really the only game in town. This is the most important thing to do is, you know, what an adventure, what an exciting adventure. And so, you know, I started in my clumsy way trying to meditate and so on. And then when I was about 15, 16, I asked the Russ Nichols, who was the old chief druid. Mm. Well, he asked me actually to photograph his ceremonies because I had a dark room at that time. Oh. And I used to, develop films and so on. And so I started, he first of all, I invited me to participate in the ceremony. And then he invited me to take photographs of the ceremony. And so I would go and meet him in his house and show him the photos. And that was our excuse, really, to be talking about druidry. And gradually the photographs fell away. And I asked if I could join the order when I was 16. And he said no. And,
really?
And yes, he said, you've got to wait till you're 18. And you know what 2 years is like for a kid. It's like forever.
God, yeah, really?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So I waited till I was 18, and I was initiated on Glastonbury Tour when I was 18.
Wow, that must have been quite an experience, being up on the tour.
Up on the tour with my druid teacher, although he was elderly, he was very good with keeping in touch with sort of what was happening in the world. So he'd made contact with a band called the Third Ear Band. Have you ever heard of it?
No, I haven't.
It's very, it's still got its fans today, the Third Ear Band. Very interesting kind of music. And he got them, and they were playing up on Glastonbury Tour. That was in 1969.
Wow.
It possibly 1970, I think, 1970.
Wow, amazing. Absolutely amazing. It's something to give me memories of some of the old folk. But I used to be in the, I used to do Civil War enactments and some of the bands in the beer tents on a Saturday night. Anyway, that's a different story. So, I mean, you know, Druidry, it's kind of very endemically British, as or at least a lot of people think of it that way. Lots of people will kind of have pictures of people being in Stonehenge and all of that kind of stuff. But, you know, that's obviously a perception. What's the reality of Druidry, or indeed kind of like earth-based spirituality, kind of as it's relevant today?
Yeah. I think, you know, as sort of human beings, we like to have these labels, and we want to naturally, in order to understand things. And it's always important to sort of use labels and then blow them up and use them and blow them up. You know, I was watching a film last night on Hinduism. And it talked about how, and it was so like Druidry. I mean, all the similarities in terms of, how the word Hindu was a word that was used for people in the Indus Valley. And then it was never really used. If you went back in time, it was never really used until, you know, later on and so on. And in fact, the amount of beliefs and activities that are encompassed by this word is so vast. You know, you start to wonder whether it's a helpful word at all. And so Druid, in a similar way, at one level, you can say it's like a green religion, or it's a nature spirituality, it's an earth spirituality. It's a way of being in the world that reverences the natural world and doesn't feel separate from it. So it doesn't treat the natural world like a stepping stone. You know, that really the afterlife is somewhere else, or nirvana is somewhere else, and it's all about moving on to this other life.
Mm-hmm.
What some people refer to as an embodied spirituality, where you say, no, I'm here now in this extraordinary, beautiful, diverse, and difficult sometimes world. And historically, the ancient druids spanned a sort of territory from Ireland, possibly across to as far as Anatolia, but we don't know.
Wow.
And that the peoples who, if you have to wind the clock back even further, actually, to really, you know, if you think of the sort of out of Africa movement of the human race,
mm-hmm.
and then people moving from the sort of Caspian Sea region, some of them moving down into India, and others mm-hmm. moving across into northwestern Europe. And so you end up with, which is what's called the Indo-European arc.
Right.
So one end of the arc down in India and the other end of the arc in Ireland. And then you start to look at the similarities in language. So you get these extraordinary similarities in, say, Irish and Sanskrit, and similarities in mythology and so on. And so there's a suggestion that these were the same people who dispersed in two different directions.
Fascinating.
And then if you can imagine this kind of shamanistic, animistic, probably goddess-centered, you know, nature goddess-centered spirituality arising in Western Europe, and all turning around reverence for natural phenomena like the stars and the moon and the sun and the trees and so on, and then gradually this group of people called the Druids arose, you know, who were written about by the classical authors, you know, the Greeks and the Roman authors. For several thousand years, they were a priesthood across this territory. But specifically, there are suggestions that it arose in mainland Britain. You know, we can't be sure about any of this stuff historically, but the suggestions are it arose in mainland Britain and traveled, you know, over to Ireland and down across to Brittany and so on. And then it died out with the coming of Christianity. It died out, sort of integrated in all sorts of different ways for about 1,000 years. And then in the 18th century, it was revived. People became interested in it again. And we've got about 300 years of recorded history of a sort of modern Druid movement. So that's a very broad sort of view of what it is. And then it's achieved a kind of, it had a kind of renaissance in the late 20th century as ecological awareness started to develop, you know, in the 1980s and 1990s and so on. And following on also from that great influx from the hippies and the, you know, that turning on to Eastern spirituality, generally awakening to their spirituality. And then it's taken on a kind of, with the increasing threats to the environment in the last few years, it's taken on an even greater kind of renaissance now, you know.
Wow. Well, I mean, I certainly, you know, my first encounter of Druidry was in the 90s. So part of that late 20th century revival and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And obviously, as you say, the situation has accelerated. And obviously it's the amount of kind of Gen Z kind of activists we're seeing, that kind of thing, is kind of huge. So what is the, you know, for the people out there that kind of maybe are kind of thinking, well, you know, I don't want to go down a specific prescribed path, or, you know, I don't want any religion or anything like that, and there's that kind of sense of like they're being accepting, what is the relevance or the opening for Druidry in the 21st century, as it were?
Yes. Well, you know, the word Druid in a way says it all, because it's made up of two syllables, Drew and Id. And there's a couple of theories about the origin of that word, but one that we can focus on is Drew, which comes from the root for oak tree. So Id, the early Indo-European root for knowledge or wisdom. If we extend that, if we sort of allow that meaning to unfold, you can mean it means a forest sage, if you like. The oak tree, the tree, the forest, the wisdom, knowledge, you know, the sage. So a druid is a forest sage.
Oh, I love
that. And what we see more and more is this understanding of the value of trees. And I think, you know, I don't know how you feel, but, you know, when you come across an absolutely splendid tree, you know, you can be going for a walk and you just come across some sort of massive, beautiful, amazing tree. That's always the closest I feel to worship. Worship is the sort of word that I use normally. But, you know, there's a part of you that just wants to get down on your knees and say, my God, you're so beautiful.
Absolutely.
I love you. I worship you. You know, I try that on my wife, but it doesn't work.
Yeah, slightly different ego structure there, maybe.
Yes, exactly. The trees are much more better. Yes, so there we go. So I think more and more people feel this way. You know, when you say this to people, I mean, a tree hugger used to be a rude word. You know, you say, oh, you know, tree huggers. You know, people don't say that anymore. You know,
no, they don't.
They don't. You know, it's because people just know thanks to, you know, David Attenborough and, you know, mm-hmm. Greta Thunberg and all these wonderful people and all the initiatives, we know that trees are absolutely vital, you know, and we see people like Bolsonaro in the, you know, having, you know, just allowing logging in the Amazon. Oh, and I think everybody's just outraged by it. We can't believe it, you know. So Drudry, in a way, you know, at some level, I feel it's like a spirituality whose time has come because this, you know, it's a bit like the title for your podcast, The Sacred Wild. It's like we need the wild, we need wilderness, and we need to have a sacred attitude towards it.
I couldn't agree more. Yeah, I think it was one of the things that set me down this kind of notion of this exploration was, I think it was Alan Cohen, said something along the lines of, you know, so many of our modern issues can be traced back to our alienation from the natural environment.
Yeah.
And, you know, and good old, you know, Don Miguel Ruiz talking about the domestication of the human spirit in the Four Agreements. So yeah. It seems we are in this need of wild, for sure, as it were.
Yeah.
You know, there's also something this points to of an increasingly technological world. On the other parts of Druidry, of course, the shamanism, is the ancient, the eternal wisdom, as it were. Mm. So, you know, what? Given that, you know, your work encompasses more than just kind of Druidry and that kind of shamanic aspect, kind of bringing in the Eastern and sophrology and that kind of thing, what for you is the need and the role of kind of eternal or ancient wisdom in this crazy technological world we live in?
Well, yes. Well, I think you, by using the word crazy, you hit the nail on the head there, is that, you know, that the world and events seem increasingly crazy, don't they? You know, mm-hmm. and of course, one's mind turns to politics, and you know, and you think this is insane. And so we need more and more. The crazier the world gets, the more we need approaches, techniques, methods that help us find some degree of sanity, that help us to maintain some sort of equilibrium and to be able to function in the world and so on. And to give us hope. And so the we're in this incredibly privileged position now of having access to the wisdom of all these spiritual traditions around the world, but also access to a kind of scientific understanding, which when it's right. put together, when the two are put together, it's fabulous, you know. So you got all this sort of wonderful research that's done now in neuroscience and in positive psychology, where people can no longer deny. I mean, if you take something really simple like, you know, the feeling gratitude for life and for the gifts that life mm-hmm. bring, and it's something that spiritualities have always taught, you know, and so even down to, you know, the things that, you know, we did at school every day, you know, when I was a kid, the grace, you know, thank you for this mm-hmm. meal sort of thing, which we all rebelled against furiously when we were kids, you know. But of course, this gratitude, now they've done all sorts of experiments and you can prove that it actually makes people feel better, you know, and it's scientifically Absolutely. Proven, you know. So we're in a fantastic, on the one hand, you know, the world's a mess and there are all sorts of terrible threats to well-being and humanity and all the rest of it, and to all the species. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, we're in this incredibly exciting era where we have access to all this stuff. And for me, Druidry, the way I sort of understand it and use it is it's a particular, you know, I hold my love of nature really dear, as it were, and love mm-hmm. and spirituality, And so I used my sort of druid basket, as it were, into that I put my spirituality and my interest in psychology and all the rest of it. And of course, now with eco-psychology, the psychologists are getting into it as well. They're understanding that tuning to nature and to the wild is good for people. So that all these sort of strands are coming together now, and you can weave, weave a really good basket with these particular strands.
Yeah, absolutely. And it seems like this year especially, I mean, we used the word crazy for technology earlier, but even crazier this year for obviously the pandemic and the impact of that, and people being under severe amounts of lockdown. It seems like, certainly I remember back in kind of, you know, March, April, May, when you were allowed out for 1 hour a day, you know, out into the outdoors, suddenly nature became a thing for everyday folks as well. What is it for you that is so, I don't know, what is it about us needing nature so much? I know that's probably a very big question, but.
Well, I think there's lots of ways you could answer. Just one that comes to me is getting out of the box. If we think in terms of boxes, here are you and I in front of little boxes.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's great that we're able to do this, and it's lovely. But we're sitting in front of a box. What we'll probably do is, after we've talked, we'll go down into the kitchen and open a box of something, mix it with a bit of water and heat it up and eat it. And then after a long day, we'll relax by sitting in front of another box.
Absolutely. It's true.
All the time we'll be in the bigger box of our flat or our house.
Mm-hmm.
We'll then get into one of the little boxes inside the box, which is the bedroom, and go to sleep. We'll wake up in the morning. And then if we have to go to work, we'll open the box of cereal, tip it in.
Absolutely.
Climb into the box of the car, drive to the glass and steel box in the city, and spend the day in front of little boxes. And then eventually we'll be carried out in a box. So, and of course that's a very gloomy and hopefully our lives aren't quite as limited as that. But that's kind of characterizes a lot of people's urban lives. So what do we want to do? We want to break out of the boxes, and we need to, you know, we're part of nature. One of the big things we have to sort of get over really is talking about us and nature, as if nature is the outside world.
Yeah.
And then we're different. Of course, we are nature. And, you know, one of the things that I'm so glad that we did is for 20 years, well, it's ongoing actually, but for 20 years I was, and my partner Stephanie were responsible for Druid camps that we held.
Oh, yes.
And so our kids would come along to these camps, and, you know, we had them four times a year, you know, and the kids would always come to the summer camps. And so their childhoods were, they were brought up in this, you know, being out in the wild where you just have, you know, a fire pit and you know, some benders and, you know, incredible adventures.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember one time coming to Oxfordshire and the fire pit just being a lake of water of mud.
Did you go to a Druid camp once?
Oh, yeah, I've been to a few.
Oh, really? Were they the Eobod ones? Were they the ones?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Oh, wow.
Yep. Were you at the if it was a pool of water? Were you at the one where they made a T-shirt saying "I survived the Eobod camp of whenever it was 1990"? Where everybody got a bug and they were throwing up everywhere.
No, fortunately, I have heard of that infamous camp. I have heard of that. No, I was at one. Within about 2 hours of the camp starting, the fire had been taken into one of the yurts. Into one of the stoves because it was so wet and rainy that it was pretty mad. I remember kind of the first time I met Ron Hutton. He was kind of wandering around in the waterproof, kind of looking quite dismayed at the amount of that the biblical flood was happening. It was quite an experience. but that's part of it, right? So
that's part of it. I mean, that the one I was referring to was one where I turned up to give a talk. I couldn't attend the whole thing. I could only just turn up for the day. And to my intense embarrassment, I'd managed to book a room in a hotel in a little pub called the Old Trout or something by the river. And they had one of those offers where they gave you a suite for the price of a room. So I'd actually spent the night in a suite and had a hot bubble bath in the morning and a nice pub breakfast. And then I drove to this sort of medieval scene of complete devastation. A storm had broken down and everybody was ill, you know, but it was great because everybody was so happy. And then they made a T-shirt the next year saying, I survived the, you know, camp 2001 or whatever it was. You know.
And that camp has become legend, let's face it.
Yeah, it has.
Brilliant. I absolutely love it. I absolutely love it. So talking of such things then, there's obviously, you know, obviously there are things like the, you know, the Order of Bards, Ovates of Druids and Druid camps and all this kind of thing. And, yeah. You know, using words like order and all that kind of thing seem quite, you know, to the unfamiliar can sound quite, I don't know, something or other.
Yes. I mean, I spent the 32 years that I was chief of the order, I spent 32 years trying to work out how I could get rid of the name chief, because the name chief kind of bothered me, you know, because it sounds, I don't know, it just sounded odd to me and unnecessary. And, you know, every so often I'd brainstorm with people and, you know, and we never came up with, you know, and the same thing with the order, you know, I used to, you know, should we call it a fellowship? Should we call it a community? Should we call it, you know, you know, and we, you know, never got around to changing it, but the order, it comes out of the tradition of magical orders from the sort of Victorian period, I suppose, you know, the Order of the Golden Dawn. And it doesn't come out of the tradition of the monastic orders.
Right.
I think probably people who aren't familiar in this world think it's like a monastic order, the order of, you know, the Order of St. John and St. Michael or something. Mm-hmm. You know? But it doesn't come out of the monastic tradition. It comes out of the magical tradition. The only thing I think it, you know, a couple of things work in its favor, which is it takes the personality out of it. So people join the order. They don't join to follow a guru. They don't join to follow an individual. They join an entity, a society, an organization. So that's one value it has. There's a sense in which, for some of us, the concept of order is rather refreshing, because life is so chaotic, you know, our own personal lives and the world out there there's such chaos. But to join an order, you know, immediately you start to say, "Oh, thank God, there's some order." You know,
although things still tend to run on druid time, so
they do. I know. I mean, just I'd be interested to know. Did you find it as a young chap? Did you find it slightly off-putting and sort of weird that it was called an order?
Well, not so much actually for me. I mean, you know, my dad was from India, my mum's English, and so they said to me at the age of six, go and find your own beliefs. So right. For me, I was an esoteric seeker from a very young age. So that's why I'm quite, when you said about like the Indo-European arc. I was suddenly fascinated by, oh, there are my two things. So yeah. No, it was actually a really interesting thing. It's like quite mysterious really and all that kind of stuff. But that said, I had to go all the way to America to meet a fellow who was a member of the order. And so I traveled 6,000 miles just to join an order that was back in my home country. So yeah, quite a weird little path. The word order was part of the intrigue for me, I think.
Oh, good. Oh, well, that's nice to know. Yeah, that's good to know. Yeah.
So very, very, very cool.
And just in case we forget it, that Indo-European art thing, we've got a whole section on the website, druidry.org, called we've got a project called the One Tree Gathering, and we've got a whole section on the website which looks at all the connections between Hinduism, the Dharmic traditions of Hinduism, Buddhism, and Jainism, and Druidism. You know, and there are articles and talks and all sorts of stuff. And we have a group. We meet up under this One Tree Gathering umbrella. At the Hindu temples and in various places. We've been doing it for about 8 years.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah,
absolutely amazing. I think offline at some point I'd love to find out a little bit more, But yeah, there you heard it, ladies and gents. So from the druidry.org, as it were. Yeah. So kind of for those people that aren't kind of ready to kind of make a jump into an order or community or society or fellowship or whatever we want to call it, but there is this kind of want to start engaging more meaningfully with nature.
Mm.
You know, but you know, maybe they live in a flat or they live in the city or an urban environment, all that kind of thing. As a man of wisdom in this area, what would you say to them about how to engage kind of meaningfully?
Well, I think one way, I mean, you know, one obvious way is just to get out.
Mm.
You know, is just, there's always, I think the trouble with urban life or with modern life, I should say, because it can apply even wherever you're living, is there's that sort of law of entropy where it's just much easier to stay cozy at home. There's this sort of effort to get out the door, particularly through the winter, you know.
Yeah.
And you know, but I'm sure everybody's familiar with that feeling of, you know, once you make the effort, you put on the boots and the coat and the hat and the scarf and get out there, you know, you're glad that you've done it. And, you know, one of the things that the lockdown, I think, has taught so many people is that we weren't as familiar with our locale as we thought we were.
Mm.
You know, I mean, you know, I live on the in the South Downs, in the South Downs National Park here. So we're surrounded by countryside. I thought I knew the footpaths around here and the countryside. But of course, what I've discovered is that there are loads of footpaths that I didn't know existed.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and we've had some amazing adventures. You know, so the first thing is to just get out. Second thing is, I think, to, you know, one good way of doing it is to work with the festival times.
Mm.
You know, say we've got the solstice coming up in about a week's time. Yeah, exactly a week's time, actually. And these are really crucial times for our sort of souls and bodies, even. You know, the way that the nights are getting longer up for those of us in the Northern Hemisphere, it's getting darker and darker. And that's affecting our physiology. You know, it's changing our endocrinal systems, you know, vitamin D levels, all that sort of stuff. And you know, most of us want to just curl up and go to sleep and wake up in the spring, you know. on the 21st of December, next Monday, you know, it's going to turn. The days are going to start getting longer. You know, the day that the year is reborn, that's really the beginning of the new year. The sort of cosmic, the astronomical beginning of the new year is next Monday at 10 in the morning in Britain.
Mm-hmm.
That's when the new year begins. And Christmas and the New Year celebrations on the 1st of January are just artificial, sort of man-made celebrations, just shifted on a bit. It's actually the real event occurs next Monday. And, you know, if you tune into that, A, you can, you know, enjoy that and take inspiration from that and think, thank God, now the days are going to start getting longer. Mm-hmm. Your body will start to respond as well as the weeks go by. And you can use it. You can use it to as a time to meditate, to tune in. I mean, what we do in Druidry is we, you know, we have a ceremony where we put all the lights out and we just sit in darkness, and then we light a candle to symbolize that rebirth of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, give each other good wishes for the year to come and make wishes for the year to come.
Mm.
And then there are actually seven more of those festivals. You know, there's one at the beginning of February, there's one in March, the spring equinox. Mm-hmm. And so on. And as you learn about them, you can use them as sort of markers to tune in and to create a kind of pattern in your life. Because what tends to happen is that Christmas and New Year, this is the big one.
Mm-hmm.
And we kind of go around to it. So after New Year's Day, you feel rough for a few days afterwards, after, you know, you celebrated it. And then what have you got to look forward to? Well, there's the summer holiday, the traditional summer holiday like that. Oh, right. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then you go around. And then what's coming next? Oh, well, it's Christmas again. Oh, here we are, round at Christmas. That's all there is.
Absolutely, you know? Right.
And if it get, you know, in it, it to caricature it, it's just, you know, the 2 weeks in Benidorm and the mad, you know, getting stuck in the Christmas shopping rush and maxing out your credit card at once a year, you know, like that.
Right.
But the idea of the Druid idea is that you have, and the pagan idea as well, is that you have every 6 weeks you have a festival, and they're all tied in either to astronomy or to the yearly calendar in some way. So you can just, you don't have to wait that long for another celebration and another tuning in. So after the winter solstice, you've just got 6 weeks, and then you've got Imolc, what's called Imolc, which is Candlemas in the Christian tradition, where you light candles, and it's just the glimmerings of spring beginning with the snowdrops popping up and all the rest of it.
Absolutely beautiful. And I can certainly attest, having observed the eight festivals for, God, 30 years now, it certainly gives a lot more meaning than, as you say, 2 weeks in Benidorm than the Christmas mad rush, as it were.
Exactly, yeah.
One of the things you kind of point to there as well is this kind of use of ceremony and ritual. And that's something, obviously, in modern day society, we don't tend to have that kind of structure and that kind of thing. So what kind of if someone wanted to observe the solstice next week, they weren't kind of, obviously, they were, you know, not versed in kind of pagan or Druid kind of rites, what kind of thing could they maybe think about doing to mark the time?
Sure. Yes. I mean, I think if you take the key idea of that it's a time where you tune in and open to this primal experience of darkness and light. So it's the longest night and the beginning of the new year, the rebirth of the year, if you like, of the sun. And this primal relationship goes right to the very heart of who you are. Because, you know, when you were in your mother's womb, you were in the darkness, and then blam, you were out in the light of the hospital ward. You know, imagine the shock of that for a baby, you know, but born into the light, you're in the light like that. And this basic movement from dark to light is something that's happening all the time. In fact, it happens every day. You know, you drop into the darkness of sleep, and then you wake up into the light of a new day, you know, or you come up with an idea out of the sort of darkness of no thing. An idea is born. I know, I'll start a podcast. Boom. And then it sees the light of day. So it's the creative process. So anything that encourages you to work with darkness and light, I think. Yeah. So at a very simple level, just say on the Sunday night is coming, or whenever for the solstice, you just turn all the lights out, as long as you're not afraid of the dark. If you're afraid of the dark, then, you know, don't do this. But turn out all the lights and just sit in the darkness. And there's a phrase that my Druid teacher, Nguyen Ross Nichols, used to say, which is, darkness is the fosterer of splendor. Ooh. And that's really nice, isn't it? And so the fosterer of splendor. So there's an idea that darkness midwifes or fosters or mothers or parents splendor inside you. So you sit with that as a sort of seed thought or meditation idea, and just sort of allow. And it's not like you have to think about anything, because the whole point about these things is that they take us beyond the rational, logical mind. So it's not about having to work anything out in your head. It's about just sitting in the darkness and just sort of soaking it in and allowing it to support you, and you to feel nourished by it. And that, you know, that could be if it works for you, or you're a seasoned meditator, or you like, you know, you could sit in the dark for half an hour if you wanted to, you know, or maybe it's just a few moments. And then when you feel you want the new year to begin, just light a match, light a candle, and you've got this little flame, and you say to yourself, you know, happy new year, a new year is beginning. May it be I think we can all probably say, may it be a better year than last year.
Yeah, really.
And, you know, and you know, may all beings be blessed, you know, may the earth be blessed. And just as simple as that.
Well, you know, full thought. Well, absolutely beautiful. You kind of took me there for a moment. That was awesome. Absolutely awesome. Just a couple of other things to kind of begin to kind of bring us home, as it were. I mean, you mentioned earlier about like the tree huggers and the hippies and all that kind of stuff, and purportedly astrologically, the fabled Age of Aquarius also begins on the solstice this coming year. And I kind of, you know, what are your thoughts on kind of where we are kind of heading, as it were, as a species, maybe, or in terms of like, do you feel optimistic about where we're heading in our relationship with the environment, or maybe not so much?
Well, I feel optimistic in an absolutist sense. And what I mean by that, and I think I'm right, I'm not a philosopher, but I believe in philosophy, it's called cosmic absolutism, the approach. But basically, in the grand scheme of things, I think everything's fine, because, you know, the divine, however we want to term that, mm-hmm. I believe that that reality in the cosmos is divine and sacred, and that the physical world is a manifestation within that field of divine consciousness. Mm-hmm. So I'm not a materialist who thinks that consciousness is a epiphenomenon of mind, that who thinks that consciousness is just the result of electrical signals in the brain, mm-hmm. which gives us some sort of sense of mentation, and therefore we call that consciousness. And that, but the bottom line is that the reality is just the physical world. I don't believe that. I believe the opposite, mm-hmm. which is idealism philosophically, which is that the reality is consciousness, and then within that vast cosmic reality that you could call God or the mind of God or goddess or whatever, it doesn't matter, mm-hmm. whatever it is, that there's this physical reality there. So from that perspective, I have absolute confidence that all is well, because even when, the earth is destroyed in however many million years, when it gets eaten up by the sun or whatever, we all know that that story is going to end at some point. Mm-hmm. So it's like, you know, and so the argument is about, when's the story going to end? When's the book going to end? And that the sort of panic at the moment is, oh, crikey, you know, I thought it was going to be in billions of years' time, and that humanity would exist for, you know, is it going to end, you know, at the end of this century? Is it going to end? When's it going to end? Mm-hmm. So that's the worry, is not that it's going to happen, because we know it's going to happen. The worry is when. Alan Watts said a wonderful thing. Somebody said, is everything going to be all right? And he said, no, of course it's not going to be all right. And she said, what do you mean? And he said, because you're going to die, and I'm going to die, and we're all going to die. It's not going to be all right. But that's okay, because, you know, of the wider picture. And so that's what I believe. I mean, on a gloomy day, I tend to think that the Jains got it right in the Jain tradition. And I don't know so much about the Hindu tradition or the Buddhist tradition. I just happen to know a lot more about Jainism. But I think they're probably all saying the same thing, but I'm mm-hmm. not entirely sure. Is that, you know, we've got these great cycles of time across thousands of years, and we're coming to the end of what's called in Hinduism the Kali Yuga.
Kali Yuga.
Yeah. And things are going to get tough and difficult. Mm-hmm. And you know, the numbers of people on the planet may be severely reduced, and we know there are too many people on the planet, and we know and it's awful to talk about, because people immediately think, oh my God, you're being so heartless and all the rest of it. But I mean, it's just a question of, you know, this is, you know, so they say that things are going to get really difficult. There'll be less people on the planet, and then we'll go into a new cycle, and then there'll be this lovely cycle that'll be thousands of years, where it'll all be marvelous and we'll be eating chocolates and
Find this good chocolate, that's the only thing.
That's right.
brilliant. Final question, picking up on a theme there, you know, as you say, everything comes to an end, but maybe sometimes it's just the end of a chapter rather than the end of a book, as it were. Yes. And obviously this year retired as the chosen chief of OBOD. What's next for you? What does your work look like? What is coming in your chapter, your next chapter?
After after handing over to Ema Burke, my successor in the order, I've shifted my focus a little bit towards sophrology, which is a sort of mind-body training system that is like a kind of enriched mindfulness. It's working in the same way that Druidry is within what you might call embodied spirituality. And it's particularly good for people with anxiety and so on. And so I've started a sort of online training program in that. But in addition to that, what's always interested me has been the place where psychology and spirituality meet. Mm-hmm. They're like sort of two circles, and then the sort of overlap. There's a territory where they both meet.
Absolutely.
That's incredibly fertile territory. And and I've always pursued both, and I've just shifted slightly the emphasis over to the psychology. So I'm working more in psychotherapy and with the Institute of Psychosynthesis that I worked with, and with the Synthesis Institute in Holland as well.
Awesome.
That's sort of what I'm up to now.
That's really exciting. That's really exciting. That's absolutely awesome. Well, thank you so much for your wisdom, for your energy, and for your insight today. It's you've been someone I've wanted to interview for a very long time, and it definitely lived up to billing, as it were. So just for people who want to find you, Philip, online, where can they find you?
Well, I've got a website, which is Philip Carr Gorm, and then that's the little dash, the hyphen between the car and the Gorm. So it's Philip and then CARR-GOMM.com. And that's my website. And the courses, the various online courses, I'm really enjoying. Of course, the pandemic has just sort of intensified that, really. But I'm really enjoying working with these online courses. I've got one on magic, on the tarot, on sophrology, on sleeping better, because so many people have problems with
sleep. Oh, God, absolutely.
And a free program of very deep meditations, yoga nidras, or druid nidras, as they're sometimes called, where yoga nidras, but with sort of druid influences. And they're all, you can see that all under the tab courses on my website.
Awesome. Absolutely awesome. And I have to say, just to just picking up on the tarot one, Philip was the co-creator of the Druidcraft tarot, which is my pack is over there looking decidedly manky from being overused for the last 15 years or however long. So thank you for that as well. So thank you so much for today. It's been an absolute pleasure. So there you go, ladies and gentlemen, for listeners of the Sacred World podcast. That was Philip Carr Gorm. And with that, we wish you a very happy solstice coming up. And thank you for listening. We'll see you next time. Bye for now. Thank you so much for joining me on the Sacred World podcast. I really hope you enjoyed this episode and got something meaningful out of it. And if you did, please consider leaving a review on iTunes. Those reviews really help us out, and they're what keep us here. Also, please make sure to hit subscribe and share this podcast with your friends and loved ones. And with that, many blessings, and I look forward to seeing you next time on the Sacred Wild podcast. Bye for now.